Stretchy, I'm telling you, stretchy. F. Murray Abraham, stretchy pants.
Well, you know, Picard, he pulls off his pips for this movie. I wonder if he pulls off his pants and puts something a little more casual on.
Well, he did change out of his uniform.
Picard's casual pants.
Yes. Yeah. No uniform, no orders.
Actually, he changed into a pair of 300-year-old pants. How old are your pants, Captain?
This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Well, welcome everybody to episode 30 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Mike Morrison, and with me is my esteemed co-host, Zachary Frühling. In this episode, we'll be discussing the philosophy behind Star Trek Insurrection. Zachary, is that a gorch?
How do you do that? You throw me for a loop every time. No, Mike, I think that's just a little lens flare in your eye. thanks for checking, though.
Yeah, just looking out for you.
I've got a question for you, actually. Okay. Before we get started, this is a really important question now. How old are you? You look like you're about 300. especially tonight, you're looking a little tired, maybe 301. You look really wise, you know, about as wise as Inej does in Insurrection. That's why I'm asking.
Well, if I looked half as good as Inej does in Insurrection, I'd be doing all right. But I don't know. Maybe it's the aggressive tendencies that I'm feeling right now.
So you look youthful. I've got no gorge, and we're, you know, our alabaster brows look fine. So.
Okay. Well,
we're looking good tonight, everyone.
We're looking good tonight. We're looking good. And here we are at episode 30. Who would have thunk it, as they say? This is exciting. And I'm excited to be talking about Star Trek Insurrection because, Zachary, as you and I were talking in the turbo lift, this happens to be one of my favorite Star Trek movies. And I know that it doesn't get a lot of love sometimes from the fans, which surprises me because I feel as though this particular movie has a lot of really good things to say. It dives into some pretty deep topics, and it tells a heck of a story. The cinematography is there's just nothing really to dislike, in my opinion, about this movie. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I'm with you on that. Insurrection has always been one of my favorite Star Trek The Next Generation movies. We were talking before the show that it's actually really hard for me to rank my favorite Star Trek The Next Generation movies. You know, I tend to go back to First Contact like a lot of people, but I love the moral dilemma that you get inside Insurrection. I'm not a Nemesis hater. I know a lot of people don't like Nemesis. I actually really like Nemesis too. So they're all about kind of even for me. But Insurrection for me... It's interesting to think about because when I think about watching Insurrection and kind of the build up to it, for me, this just takes place at a really specific time in the history of film and the history of my Star Trek fandom. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, Star Trek Insurrection was the first movie trailer that I remember watching online and seeing it online before I saw it on TV. And that says something about the build up for this movie. I think the, you know, while there were movie trailers before that, this is, you know, right about the time when I got an internet capable computer and there was all this buzz on the internet about yet another Star Trek The Next Generation movie. And I was so excited. And I remember the trailer with this, you know, this sort of pristine looking village and the movie guy voice doing the voiceover, kind of imagine a world in which whatever he said about, I can't remember the trailer, but whatever he said about the movie, and imagine a world in which people never age or whatever he said, you know, the fountain of youth or whatever the dialogue was. It just sticks out in my mind so much. So Mike, one of the things I remember most about seeing this movie in the theater for the first time is that here in my hometown in Vacaville, the local Star Trek fan club was doing like a trivia Q&A before the showing of the movie. And I remember to this day the question that they asked the fans, the very first question, and they were giving away like a Star Trek Insurrection lightboard movie poster, you know, one of the backlit ones that they use for real movies. It's not a poster, but like a backlit movie poster. It was really cool. The question that they asked was, what planet did Captain Kirk fight the evil Dr. Soran on in Star Trek Generations? And my hand shot up and I said, Viridian 3. And I remember the whole theater looked at me like, how the hell do you know that? And the answer was, well, I'd literally just watched it the night before. It was already out on video and I'd watched it and I remembered it vividly. So I got the answer right. I got my movie poster, which I still have. It's in storage somewhere. And all of that, you know, from seeing the trailer to this trivia experience to the buildup to just being at that age, kind of in my, let's see, what year did this movie come out, Mike?
December 1998.
1998. So I was 20 years old, you know, so in my late teens, early 20s, Star Trek had been on for a long time, was always a huge fan. And this was yet another Star Trek movie. I was so jazzed about this movie. So all of that colors my perception of this movie, maybe even more so than the movie itself. But I really like the moral dilemma that you get inside this movie. And I'm looking forward to tearing it apart a little bit.
Fantastic. Well, shall we dive in?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I guess we kind of shared our initial thoughts already, but do you have any initial thoughts on the movie itself beyond what we've already said?
Well, as I said before, I think there are some really interesting themes throughout this movie, and one of those themes we'll dive into in some degree, I'm sure, is the idea or the philosophy, rather, of the ethics of colonialism. We get a really interesting challenge to the Prime Directive in this movie. We challenge the idea that the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. There's just a lot to love. And the fact that we find out that Dr. Crusher is a heck of a shot.
It's like Dr. Crusher's big scene, you know. She spent years on The Next Generation essentially having a talking role. Now she gets to hold a phaser rifle and kneel behind that rock and fire, and that's her big scene.
Yeah, it's like skeet shooting. She's just taking them out left and right.
So who's more aggressive in this movie? Is it Dr. Crusher with her phaser rifle, or is it Worf feeling aggressive tendencies?
I don't know. You know, Worf checks that phaser rifle when he realizes the power cell is drained, and he just takes a thing and Babe Ruth's one of those probes. It's one of my favorite lines in the movie. Definitely feeling aggressive tendencies, sir.
Yeah, but you know, the thing you're mentioning, the character interaction is really, really lighthearted in this movie. And I think that is one of those things you either love it or you hate it. You know, coming off the heels of Generations, which was a fairly serious movie, and First Contact, which was a fairly serious action movie. And now you get to see the characters and the actors lightening up a bit. You know, you get to see the characters interacting with each other, laughing together, telling jokes with each other. And they really kind of went maybe a little over the top. You know, it doesn't bother me too much. It's really silly. And there are a couple lines that make me roll my eyes like a lot of folks. Like the line about, you know, Dr. Crusher and Counselor Troy saying their boobs are firming up. You know, that it's hard not to get an eye roll about lines like that. But generally, the humor works. You know, what's fun about the Next Generation cast, of course, is all the actors like each other and they get along and they laugh together. And it was a goofy set whenever they get together to do anything, even for panels at conventions.
Yeah.
Right? It devolves into goofiness pretty quickly.
Yes.
And that carries over into this movie, I think, way more than it did in the Next Generation and way more than it did in the other two movies. And it's fun to see the actors kind of just hamming it up a bit. I'm not sure it really shows off the great range of the of the actors, but you can tell the actors like each other and they're having fun, and it doesn't bother me. If anything, it might be a distraction from the seriousness of the moral dilemmas in the movie, so much so that this movie, I think, gets branded as a lighthearted movie to the detriment of the issues that are going on in the movie. I mean, there are some fun, interesting you know, deep philosophical issues to talk about. Like you said, colonialism, this issue about consequentialism and, mm-hmm. and the how you prioritize different groups of people with different numbers and whatnot. Really, really interesting moral dilemmas. But, you know, really, this is the movie where, you know, Dr. Crusher and Counselor Troy talk about their boobs firming up for most people.
Well, the best part of that, Zachary, was Data going and saying the same, you know, just repeating verbatim what he had just overheard to Worf. And that momentary look on Worf's face before they realize that the probes are coming in, and then everything gets, you know, pew-pew again. But the lightheartedness of the movie, I think, is one of the things that I appreciate about it. And I know from reading some articles associated with this movie many, many years ago when Michael Piller signed on to write this movie, that was one of his stipulations. He wanted something a little lighter hearted. He wasn't particularly happy with the darkness that seemed to be so predominant within First Contact. So he wanted a lighter hearted story, and he certainly got it, I think, with Insurrection, but he was still able to tell a lighthearted story and get that, get that moral play in there and get these issues kind of hashed out within it. I think, too, some of the lightheartedness, you're exactly right, comes from the chemistry of the cast. They certainly have it. And I think most of our listeners are Star Trek fans. If you all haven't had an opportunity to actually go and see the Next Gen cast at a convention, you certainly owe it to yourself to do that. I got to see him a couple of years ago here in Dallas at Comic-Con. And I've got to say, after all these years, they still have wonderful chemistry. They yuck it up. They tell stories. They joke. They play off of one another. That hasn't changed a bit. They're all just still, in my opinion, the top of their game. And the chemistry has just never gone away with these guys. And I think that really comes through in a strong, strong way in Insurrection. And that chemistry, I think, really makes the movie special, at least in my opinion.
Sometimes I feel like Star Trek fans look at Star Trek through rose-colored glasses. You know, they like the deep morality plays, and they like the darker movies and the serious things, and they forget how utterly ridiculous, you know, the actual Star Trek show can be at times. Mm-hmm. Every Star Trek series has delved into the utterly ridiculous at one point or another. And it's an interesting question, maybe a question for another podcast, since I do want to talk about the moral and ethical dilemmas and the morality plays inside this movie as our main topic. But do those kinds of lighthearted, ridiculous moments transfer onto the big screen really well? Can that be done well, or is that always kind of fall a little flat? And even in Insurrection, as much as I love Insurrection, even for me, it falls a little bit flat, and it's a little too much. And as much as I love it, and I like seeing the characters interact, and I like the humor, it does sort of feel like it feels out of place, even in a movie as lighthearted as Insurrection. So I'm not sure if we want to dive into that or not, but it's an interesting question about whether that small scale humor translates onto the big screen.
Yeah, it's interesting because you and I were talking in the Turbo Lift, and we're divided on a few things about this movie. We both feel very fondly for the movie, but you know, we're divided. So some of that lightheartedness, I think, falls flat with you. For me, I think it makes this whole thing seem that much more real, because let's face it, life isn't always drama and the intense fantasy violence, and you're not going to live that all the time. There are going to be lighthearted moments. There are going to be fun moments. And you get that with this movie. Another thing that you and I were talking about, the makeup in this movie kind of fell flat with you, and particularly with the alien species. For me, some of them felt, and I'm a Doctor Who fan, so for me, a lot of the alien species felt very Doctor Who to me. And I thought that was pretty cool. Several of the alien species felt like something, you know, right off of, you know, Doctor Who. And I thought that was rather fun. And I admired the makeup in this movie.
Yeah, it's interesting because for me, that really does not work terribly well. The Sona in particular just feels like they, you know, they slapped some colored makeup and they wrapped them up in some bandages and said, okay, now we've got our aliens, and they can't look like Klingons, and they can't look like Vulcans, and they can't look like Romulans, and they can't look like Andorians. So what else can we do? I don't know. Let's put them in some bandages. And, you know, it makes sense given the situation for that so-called race inside the movie. But yeah, it just didn't look very coherent to me. Like, they really did kind of slap it together. And you know, I can't speak to how designed it actually was, but it didn't look like it was the most convincing new alien race.
That's one of those fun little chicken and egg kind of questions. I think if we could get Larry Nemechek to join us sometime, I think I'd like to ask him about this, because I find it interesting. This particular species were referred to or called themselves the Sona. And the etymology of the word is associated with skin, with beauty, with perfection. So I thought that to be an interesting name. I'd be interested to find out if they were named the Sona first and that's how we portrayed them on the screen, or, you know, if we came up with this whole thing, they were stretching their faces and getting facelifts and all this stuff going on, and then, oh, hey, by the way, let's call them the Sona.
Yeah, I think the Sona gave themselves that name after they realized how beautiful they looked after their face stretching. You know, they after the very first person to lay down to experience this, they got up, looked in the mirror and said, I look good. Sona.
Sona smooth, baby. You know, on the other hand, we have the poor Baku. Baku is Hindi for wind pounded city. So.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yes. So, I think that's an interesting play on words, considering, you know, what is this wind, so to speak, that's about to whisk these people away from this beautiful village that they have. And I think this is a great place to just kind of start to dive in and talk about some of the moral and ethical issues of this particular movie.
Well, for me, the main ethical dilemma is this dilemma about what to do about different groups of people in different numbers. You know, you've got a small group of indigenous people, you know, no shortage of parallels to other instances we see in Star Trek. I'm thinking of things like that episode of The Next Generation where there's an issue about relocating Native Americans. Mm-hmm. You know, this is an issue that crops up again and again and again in Star Trek. So I like that there's a theme here, you know, with a sort of a longstanding theme in Star Trek going back to those episodes all the way into this movie. But so there's this issue. There's this small group of indigenous people, and there's a morality play, a choice to be made, right? If we move them and we can use the planet and this collector to get the whatevers to prolong our lives and rejuvenate ourselves, however the teching the tech works to make that work, right? then we can help potentially millions or billions of people. So, you know, from the perspective of Admiral Dougherty in the movie, it's just a straight up numbers play. If we sacrifice a few people here, not even kill them necessarily, just relocate them, right? If we can relocate them, then we can help millions of people. So in his mind, it's a no-brainer. And, you know, obviously it forces the issue of, like I said, this is a colonial, inherently colonial issue. When you're faced with a choice of how to interact with native peoples, you know, you can either, you know, leave them as they are, you can try to integrate, you can try to conquer them, you got a number of options. And here it really is a choice of, you know, do we leave them be and sacrifice the benefits, or do we harm these people in some way and, you know, enjoy all the benefits that this planet can bring. It's basically the trolley problem, or what we called a few episodes ago, the shuttlecraft problem. Writ large. You know, do you sacrifice a small number of people to save or help a large number of people? And so I think that the morality play is a pretty straightforward, consequentialist, you know, calculation. You know, is it just a matter of helping the greatest number of people and being willing to sacrifice a small number of people? What in my mind, what's interesting is the stance that Star Trek takes on this issue. Oftentimes in the past, Star Trek would take a consequentialist perspective. In Spock's own words, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. Mm-hmm. And here you're presented with a sort of really stark opposition to that view inside the Star Trek universe itself. You know, Captain Picard is not just concerned with the the consequences of different groups and different numbers of people. He's concerned with the rights of a small number of people. So you've got this straight up conflict between this consequentialist numbers game and the rights of the group that's in the minority. And here the two directly conflict with each other, and it's fascinating to see how it plays out in the story.
I think this is one of those areas where you get some of the criticism from fans, because we took two very familiar episodes from season 7, Homeward and Journey's End. Homeward, of course, is the episode in which Worf's adopted brother violates the Prime Directive in order to save a species of people that he's come to know and to love. He's been involved in a duck blind observation. He realizes that they're, you know, these people are doomed, and so he hatches a plan to relocate them. And then, of course, Journey's End is, as you referenced earlier, the episode in which there was some debate about how to relocate this Native American tribe who had settled in light of the treaty with the Cardassians. And so they kind of take those two episodes of TNG and they merge them into this movie. They just changed the name of the species. But I think it's interesting because they took the idea of the holodeck ship and directly from Homeward, and that's how the Baku and Admiral Doherty, that's how they're going to relocate these people. We have, you know, the idea of Journey's End because you've got that pushback against colonialism. And you're right, this is a challenge to the idea of the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. Captain Picard says in this movie, some of the darkest chapters in the history of my world involve the forced relocation of a small group of people to satisfy the demands of a large one. And so the idea of forced relocation is challenged here. And I think the dark chapter that he's referring to is right here in the United States during the 19th century, the relocation of the Indian tribes, what we famously call today the Trail of Tears. And I think you see that played out here on this alien world, you know, the relocation of just 600 people. And that becomes another challenge because Doherty says to Picard, and this is his justification, you know, hey, we're only talking about 600 people and, you know, this is going to benefit millions. And Doherty almost becomes a pitiable adversary in this particular movie, because you can almost see, and I've got to give credit to the actor, you can almost see a deadness in his reaction. It's almost as though he's just given up his own soul to do and what he said, quote, you know, this is for the Federation. I just wanted to do something for the Federation. And I think he really believed that, and I think he justified what I think he knew in his heart of hearts was the wrong thing in order to accomplish something that he felt was for the greater good. But Captain Picard pushes back against that, and he says, how many does it take, Admiral, before it becomes wrong? 1,000? You know, and so on, and he counts up. And that's a great question. How many does it take before it becomes wrong? Yeah, it's only 600 people, but I think that's an interesting challenge. I think it's an interesting problem.
Well, I like that Picard takes the what's basically a Kantian position, you know, basically saying that, look, ethical decisions like this aren't always a question of numbers. Yes, it's 600 people versus millions of people. But here we're talking about not violating the rights of the individuals that make up that small community. And we're talking about not using other people as a means to achieve your own ends. However noble those ends are, if you end up using other people merely as a means to achieve those ends, it's still wrong. And it's not a question of numbers. So in my mind, Picard just takes a straight up Kantian approach to this, that this is violating some sort of core moral principle, and the numbers are an irrelevant kind of red herring from the core issue, which is the rights of the 600 individuals in question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were talking about this in the Turbo Lift. You know, this is one of those areas, and interestingly enough, Kant didn't have a whole lot to say about colonialism, and the very little that he really had to say on the topic, I think, can be found in, I believe it's Metaphysics of Morals and Toward Perpetual Peace. And he kind of flip-flops. He shifts his position a little bit on colonialism in these two particular works. And he's somewhat gray on the issue as a whole. But he does say that one of the distinct wrongs of colonialism is that colonial conquest amounts to a way of acquiring territory through the use of force. And so we come to the conclusion here that that is wrong. It's wrong to use force in order to acquire territory, regardless of what you're going to do with it. We know this wasn't about territory per se. It wasn't like we were moving them in order to make, you know, we think about colonialism, we think about moving said people to make way for more people, more powerful people, however you want to look at that topic. We still practice it today in municipalities. We refer to it as an eminent domain. In the little town that that I'm from, a major hospital did this in order to expand its territory. It aligned itself with the city and basically conquered property in the name of eminent domain. They put out of business a lot of small businesses, including a dry cleaner that had been in that town for years and years and years. And the whole thing was, this is for the greater good of the people. That's a dry cleaner. This is a hospital. We care for sick people. They clean your clothes. You know, this is for the greater good. So we still do this today, Zachary.
Well, there's a long history of that in this country, right? This really started with the building of the railroads, right?
Yes.
In order to build the Transcontinental Railroad, you had to acquire the land, a straight path all the way across the country. And if people owned that land, it needed to be acquired. So you know, there is this kind of this longstanding tradition of making these small sacrifices, you know, in terms of individual property ownership, and regardless of the consequences that ensue, for the sake of the overall greater good. And again, what's interesting to me is this really does that is in line with Spock's general moral principle that the goods of the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few or the one. But what's interesting to me about this the take on this in Insurrection, you know, we've been talking about its relation to the Next Generation episode Journey's End.
Mm-hmm.
And what's fascinating to me is the difference in Picard's reaction to this situation versus Wesley Crusher's analogous reaction inside that episode of The Next Generation. And when I watch Journey's End, as much I love that episode, because I'm fascinated by the morality play. So you know, I'm just as fascinated by that episode as I am fascinated here. But Wesley Crusher's you know, basically violation of his orders in order to, you know, try to, you know, prevent the relocation of these people that leads to him eventually leaving Starfleet only to come back in Nemesis. You know, I'm not sure how that works out exactly, but, you know, however that unfolds, you know, Wesley's reaction to me always falls really, really flat. Like, who is this young, you know, regardless of Wesley Crusher's experience on the Enterprise, having been an acting ensign, you know, he's still a cadet mm-hmm. and he's still, you know, and he knows Picard. He has to realize Picard has thought about this issue already and Picard has had to weigh these things. And so what in the heck is Wesley Crusher doing standing up to Picard on this issue?
Yes.
It doesn't really work to me. Whereas the gravitas in Insurrection of Picard, you know, being willing to take the pips off his collar and being willing to risk a court-martial on principle here shows the seriousness of the issue way more than Wesley Crusher's, same reaction in that episode of The Next Generation, Journey's End, for me at least.
I'm glad you mentioned this because it does show a contrast to some degree. Maybe we could look at this as the development of Picard's character, and maybe he learned something from the events in Journey's End. Maybe he was inspired to some degree by Wesley's conviction, but I see a different Picard here than I think what we got in Journey's
End. Picard.
This is movie Picard. That's right.
Right.
You know, it's funny because I see some parallels too to the Voyager episode. I believe it's 1159 is the name of the episode from season 5. I think it's episode 22 or 23. And so there's that really interesting really interesting moral play of, you know, at what point does it become right? Are we gonna force this guy out of his bookstore in order to build this, you know, this futuristic mall for the benefit of everybody? Are we gonna let this guy have his little his little bookstore to cater to, you know, just a few. It's fascinating to me, and I don't think there are any easy answers. I don't think there are supposed to be easy answers. I don't think at the end of the day we really answer the moral rightness or wrongness, if I can say that, here in Insurrection. But I do believe that by virtue of Captain Picard's challenge, and he takes his pips off, because what he has to do as a man and not necessarily a Starfleet captain.
Well, I think, Mike, that's a good segue into the next item on our outline for tonight. It speaks to the importance of the responsibility of the individual when faced with a moral dilemma or when faced with seeing something that you believe is wrong. What are your sort of responsibilities to the situation or to the people who are affected by the situation? And Picard here really takes it upon himself in a really kind of first person way. He owns the situation and says, you know, I don't care what Starfleet says about it. I don't care what my orders say. I'm going to do what I think is right. And if that means a court martial, then I'm going to do it. So it shows this sort of deep moral conviction of any character who stands up to authority in that way. I think, you know, this is not a new story, right? But this is a kind of a unique take on it. So you don't see Captain Picard doing that very much, because at the end of the day, Captain Picard is essentially a Starfleet officer. He's not willing to walk away from Starfleet, you know, on moral grounds very much. You know, maybe we see that once. Do we ever see it again other than in this episode? I'm not really sure, but we don't see it very much. And one of the things I think that's just not talked about much when this episode is discussed is its relationship to things like civil disobedience. Mm-hmm. You know, Captain Picard here is placed in the situation of someone who is about to do civil disobedience. He's not going to try to start a war, but he is going to not obey his orders, and he's going to be willing to accept whatever consequences ensue from not following those orders. And anyone who participates in civil disobedience, it's like one of the basic tenets of civil disobedience is being willing to accept the consequences. If you're going to break a law intentionally to draw attention to something, then if that means they put you in jail, you have to accept the consequences of that.
Sure.
And it's all for the sake of proving a point and shedding light on something that desperately needs light shone on it. And I think Picard is doing that here. You know, he's there is some violence in this movie, right? There's a battle between the spaceships, mm-hmm. and there's a firefight down on the planet. But Picard's intention here is not to be violent for its own sake. He really wants to, move these people out of there, prevent this relocation from happening. Picard wants to find a peaceable solution, but he's willing to violate his orders to do it. So in my mind, there's just this deep connection to the politics and the ethics of civil disobedience, and it just draws attention to some of the sort of sub points of those kinds of theories. So, you know, Picard's willingness to accept a court-martial is, in my mind, very similar to Martin Luther King Jr. being willing to accept a jail sentence, you know, for violating a rule against protesting on a certain day. Mm-hmm. It's that same kind of thing. You know, you violate a rule for the sake of drawing attention to something, and you just have to live with the consequences. And if that means a court-martial, Picard is totally willing to own it. I think it speaks a lot to Picard's moral convictions. It's a good example for anyone who is faced with a moral dilemma or faced with seeing a situation that is not what it should be. I don't think we get really a strong answer to whether there's a real, deep moral responsibility to that. It's admirable that Picard, you know, is willing to throw away his career for the sake of proving a point. It is an interesting kind of follow-up question whether Picard has a moral obligation to do that or not. And that's a subtle difference, right? Is it merely praiseworthy? It's great. Yay, Picard, you're a great guy. You're willing to make sacrifices for the greater good. Or does he have a deep moral and ethical obligation? Kind of like, if you think of things like Good Samaritan laws, mm-hmm. do you have an obligation to help people in need when you see a situation like that? Or is it merely something we praise people for and we don't hold people accountable if they fail to act in a certain way? And I don't think it's obvious at all here whether Picard has a moral obligation to act or whether it's merely praiseworthy. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, one of the things that I think I admire about Picard's actions, he's willing to do this on his own, Zachary. He's not willing to put his crew in the middle of this. This is something that he has decided to do alone, to stand on his own as a man against something that he feels is simply not right. And I admire that characteristic in Captain Picard in this particular movie. And it's one of the things I think that really shines for me is his willingness to stand up and be a man and do what's right and not drag other people down that road with him. They're certainly willing to go. In fact, that's one of the things that is said about Picard in this movie. He engenders respect, and we certainly see that. We see that from his crew. His crew are willing to accept those consequences with him because not only do they agree, but I think they too admire their captain and this stand that he's about to make. Two, I think it's important to note, Zachary, that we have kind of a subtle contrast here, because not only do we have Captain Picard, and you make a great point that this is a non-violent, this is civil disobedience. And we explore this all the time. We've got a TV show that's popular right now, you know, What Would You Do?, in which we put people in situations and we ask the question, you know, what will you do? What do you do when you see someone, for instance, being mistreated because of the color of their skin? What are you going to do about that? What are you going to do if you see a woman being abused by a man? What do you do if you see somebody cheated? You know, what are you going to do about that? And this is a very popular TV show right now. So we like to explore this topic. Too, Zachary, I think we get a not so obvious contrast here. It's a very subtle contrast with the Baku, in which we find out in the course of events that they are much more advanced than we believed they were. We're observing them in duck blind. We consider them to be a pre-warp society, a pre-warp culture. But then, you know, suddenly we discover when Captain Picard goes to rescue, in irony quotes, the hostages, in irony quotes, we discover that they are actually very technologically advanced, or at least they have the capability to be. The knowledge is there. But what has happened is they have gone to this planet. They have migrated to this planet in order to isolate themselves in a sort of civil disobedience all its own. I think this is best summed up in a quote from the movie. Sojef, I believe was his name, one of the Baku, said, "We believe that when you create a machine to do the work of a man, you take something away from the man." And so there's a whole other layer of idea and philosophy kind of woven into this, mm-hmm. that I think is very interesting, because their existence on this planet to some degree is their own statement about moving too fast as a society.
Yeah, that's one of the things I really like about this movie. I like that there are these different philosophical layers kind of woven into this story. Yes, the big dilemma is this moral dilemma about numbers versus rights and whatnot. There's this stuff about civil disobedience that we talked about. But there's also this sort of running anti-technological commentary, right? A commentary on fast-paced society, on the dangers of technology. And it's interesting to see an alien race that is consciously remove themselves from technology, although they certainly enjoy the benefits of the metaphasic particles, right? And because of that, you get this interesting kind of reverse prime directive story woven in too, right? Where the Baku have their metaphasic particles and they're not going to share them. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't have to, right? It's their planet. Now, it wasn't always their planet, but now it is. And, you know, the humans want the metaphasic particles and darn it, we can't have them because the Baku are here. And, Dougherty's willing to, do what he does to try to get access to the benefits of these metaphasic particles. But I kind of imagine how this would play out in reverse, right? What if it were another alien race that desperately wanted, you know, some technology that the Federation has, and they're willing to, you know, wage war against the Federation to get that technology and whatnot. We don't really kind of see a conflict over that kind of prime directive story very much. You know, we see a prime directive story where maybe someone will violate the prime directive, but you don't see an outright conflict arise as a result of the prime directive. Usually at the ends of these Star Trek stories, you get, we'd violate the prime directive, so we can't do that. Or yes, we've decided to violate the prime directive and they can have the technology after all. And that's the end of the story. But here you get a real conflict where you know, members of the Federation are willing to relocate people and risk starting a conflict to the point where they're willing to fire on the Enterprise, mm-hmm. right? All for the sake of getting access to technology that they're not allowed to have because it's not their planet. And it's a fascinating to actually see some consequences of the Prime Directive drawn out a little bit more than they are inside your typical Star Trek story.
Yeah, and one of the points that you made earlier as well is, you know, the idea of being willing to accept the consequences. And again, one of the things that I appreciate about this was that the Baku are willing to give up the conveniences I'm sure that they had in whatever society they came from. And they also understand that there are some consequences as well, because, you know, their young people are questioning the outside world, the off world.
They don't want to apprentice for 75 years.
Who wouldn't want to apprentice for 75 years?
It's like Ensign Kim not getting a promotion, right? You know, Ensign Kim, he gets to be an ensign for 75 years. Can you imagine? That's the situation we have on this planet, right? The Baku don't get a promotion for 75 years.
And you know, the thing I find fascinating is that, you know, the Sona are all too willing to leave this society until they have to start stretching their faces out in order. I wonder how long it takes when they return back to the planet for their facelifts to revert. And
well, Mike, I think that kind of speaks to one of the other, again, just kind of subtle threads inside the movie, is this thread about reconciliation. I mean, despite all this conflict, the Baku and the Sona are the members of the same race, their family that have split apart. And there's this, you know, very charming reconciliation at the end, you know, a mother hugging her son and whatnot. It's a very sort of happy, almost a ha ha ha, you know, in the vein of the original series kind of ending, where it's, you know, it's very lighthearted and it's a happy ending. It wraps up neatly. It's a very feel good ending. And that really works for me. I think it's a nice theme that, you know, these two, you know, supposed races that are really the same race that have had this conflict can reconcile. It's the same kind of idea that you get in, like, say, in The Next Generation, unification of Spock trying to, you know, reconcile the Vulcans with the Romulans. You know, that's a charming idea, but here you get to see sort of the human element of that, you know, a mother hugging her son for the first time in however many decades it's been since the Sona left. You know, it's a good model to shoot for, that reconciliation should be the, you know, the end goal that you shoot for whenever it's possible. And I like that they wove that charming idea into the story.
I'm starting to wonder if they shouldn't have called this, rather than Star Trek Insurrection, if they shouldn't have just called this movie Klingon Puberty and Reconciliation.
Well, you know, it's funny because I remember when the movie came out. I was about 20 years old, and I don't know if I ever really knew the word insurrection. I just never, you know, it wasn't in my day-to-day vocabulary as a 20-year-old. And I'm, insurrection? What the hell is that? I remember just being totally unjazzed by the title. Like, what in the heck? And then I remember seeing the trailer, and I thought the trailer was nice looking, and was looking forward to seeing the movie. But insurrection? Okay.
Well, the thing about it, if you miss the fact that these two races are actually of the same race, that the Baku are the children of the Sona who have rebelled and who have gone off world to pursue whatever interests they have out there in the great galaxy, they've come home. In fact, that was the point that Captain Picard makes to Admiral Doherty, you know, you've drugged the Federation into a blood feud. Mm-hmm. This was a blood feud. And so, you know, if you miss that fact, then the title really doesn't make any sense whatsoever. I don't know if it was titled the best, but...
Well, it's got a great double meaning, because we've got, yes, we have Sona kind of rising up against their own parents. That's kind of an insurrection. Mm-hmm. You also have Picard's defiance of his orders. That's kind of an insurrection. So you get, you know, it's kind of shades of meaning of that title. It is a really effective title given all of that. But, you know, at the time I remember kind of laughing, like, insurrection, ha ha ha. What is that?
Well, you just got to know that when Picard takes off his pips, you know, all hell's going to break loose.
It's going to hit the fan.
Right. We've seen Picard in blue, and now we have, you know, Picard taking off his pips.
But it's going to hit the top of that blue room they were in, you know, inside the collector.
We're getting too old for this. I love that line. We're getting too old for this.
So what about this idea of, I mean, we talked about it a little bit. What about this idea of this eternal kind of fountain of youth type planet? I mean, it's a great sort of literary story, too, like this quest for the fountain of youth, right? So it's kind of in the tradition of Ponce de Leon looking for the Fountain of Youth, right? This is supposed to represent something of the Holy Grail for mankind, mm-hmm. right? If we can find the Fountain of Youth, think how much richer that will make our lives if we can cure diseases and we don't have to worry about the constraints of the human condition. In fact, it's very similar to the topic we discussed a couple of episodes ago on Metatrex about using technology to solve to basically solve the human equation, right? To remove the constraints of human existence to the point where we can improve and sort of maximally allow humans to flourish in a way they never have before. If you can find the Fountain of Youth and remove the factors of death and suffering and pain and disease and think of what life could be like for millions or billions of people, you can see why Admiral Dougherty has kind of this Ponce de Leon kind of quality, right? He's not an evil character. He sees all the good things that could bring, and it's worth it. whatever trade-off he has to make is worth it because of all those benefits. So I think they sort of overplay him as a bad admiral rather than a guy who really has good motivations. Because I think at his core, he really does want to help those people, and he kind of loses sight of that along the way. But what's your thoughts? I mean, does this represent some sort of ideal of humankind, this idea of eternal life or not having to worry about death or eternal youth? Would that allow humans to flourish, or does that take away an important part of the human equation? In my mind, the constraints of human life give life meaning. They allow you to focus on the things that are more important. They force you to make hard choices about what really matters. They can give you motivation to get up out of bed and do something because you only have so many days in this world. And if you take that out of the equation, what reason, I mean, the Baku, you can ask this really interesting question. What reason do they have to do anything? Right? They're never going to age, and they're never going to get old, and they're never going to suffer from these diseases. They essentially can live forever. I think that's the implication. They can live mm-hmm. A long time, if not forever. Then, all they do is sit around and farm their, till their soil and, weave their cloth. And is that a satisfying life, or is that missing an important part of the equation?
I think that's a great question. Sojef mentions in talking to Captain Picard that actually when he got to the planet, he was much older in appearance than he was at that particular moment. So we have the Baku who have managed Zachary to not only age gracefully, but they have the kind of moral and ethical center to be able to balance this. They're not lusting for power. They're not, they're not out there trying to bottle it and sell it. They're not looking to, make a few bars of gold pressed latinum. In fact, Captain Picard has to explain to them that what they have there is literally much more valuable to most species than gold pressed latinum. And so, I think this is an interesting sort of takeaway. And you mentioned Ponce de Leon and the search for, the Fountain of Youth. I think this is something that certainly is predominant in the world that we live in because, after all, we have a growing industry out there of, weight loss and plastic surgery and all of these things to make us look and feel younger. There's always these new, this like this perpetual cycle of new products out there to make us look and feel younger and restore your vitality. I can almost break into a commercial right now. I've seen so many of them. And so, here we have it. And this is a familiar theme throughout Star Trek as well. I'm thinking of Captain Kirk and, his own lamentings about getting older. And I think about, Captain Picard looking in the mirror, looking at himself in the mirror when it dawns on him that, hey, I'm not only feeling younger, I'm looking younger.
I'm glad you mentioned that because I to this day, that does not really play well for me. Captain Picard, I can see he's looking in the mirror and he's kind of touching his face. He's realizing that he's
firming up.
It's, well, that is okay. See, already I still feel like I don't understand this. To me, I what looked like what was happening is that maybe the gray in his beard was actually going away, and it was darker than he expected it to be. You know, he's got a little bit of, you know, 5 o'clock shadow, and it actually shows. It's not gray. That's what it looked like to me. But you think it's his face is firming up? Why didn't he like rub his head? Like his baldness is going away.
See,
his hair's growing
back.
I think
they could have put him in a toupee and probably had a little bit more effect. Yeah, I agree, because it wasn't until he knocked on her door and asked her, how, you know, what kind of question is this? You know, you're really interested in a woman, and you go knock on her door and she opens up the door. She's looking, you know, particularly beautiful. And you say, how old are you?
Yeah, and it's funny because it didn't really click for me that that's what was going on until that moment.
Yes.
And maybe it's not supposed to, but I just wonder if how much of those little clues that we're supposed to get along the way really were intended by the filmmakers for people to really kind of like figure it out, you know, beforehand. And I totally missed it. And to this day, I kind of go, really? That's it? You know, he's kind of touching his face and we're supposed to figure it out from that. And, you know.
Yeah, I missed it too. And there are clues throughout the movie, but they're very, very subtle clues. And honestly, a lot of the clues actually are after that particular scene where he's looking at himself in the mirror and, you know, touching his face, feeling that his face is firmed up a little bit. You know, you already mentioned the conversation between Counselor Troy and Dr. Crusher about their boobs firming up. And, you know, we have Riker and Troy rekindling some of the feelings that they had when they were younger.
Youthful feelings.
Riker gets that sultry little bathtub beard shave. And so we've got these little subtle clues.
Well Riker. Riker's getting, you know, he's kind of double dipping a little bit in this episode. You know, he's got the action with Troy because he's feeling rejuvenated. You know, he got the bathtub scene and all this, right? You know, Troy and her bath bubbles and Riker shaving and all this stuff. And then you get, you know, Riker, kind of tantalizing the ensign across the way when he says, I'm going to take this gas from this nebula and I'm going to shove it down the Sona's throat. And clearly the Trill ensign next to him likes that. And she gives him a look and he looks back a little bit. Riker's, he's feeling youthful in this episode.
Well, this is,
as he often
this
does,
is a but. Jonathan Frakes movie. So I do believe that he was the executive producer of this one.
So, you know, the working title was something like, you know, Riker feels rejuvenated.
Riker's rejuvenation.
Riker's rejuvenation, exactly. That's like every episode of The Next Generation, every other episode of The Next
Every
Generation,
other episode. Right? I've got to say, though, I have to say that, and I am team Riker beard all the way. But I've got to say, Frakes really looked great in this movie without the beard.
Yeah, it was interesting because this is the nice thing you can do in movies. You can make these big changes you can't do in a series. I mean, yes, Riker grew a beard at some point, but from that point on, he kept the beard and that was that. And he wasn't going to shave it off again until the very end of The Next Generation, right? When they do the flashback to Encounter at Farpoint.
Yes.
But in a movie, you can do those things, right? You know, you're only going to do it every so often. A number of years have passed. Characters are going to change. And I do like that you see some character change inside this movie. So,
well, and I think that's a great segue into some of the things I think this movie kind of says about the human condition. You know, certainly I think there's the idea that it's never too late to act on one's feelings and to reclaim or piece together a lost relationship. I think we see that with Riker and Troy. We see that with the Sona and his Baku mother at the end of the movie. You mentioned that earlier. I think that was a particularly moving scene for me, that reconciliation between a mother and a son. I think, you know, certainly you see a lot of that throughout this movie that, you know, you don't have to find the fountain of youth in order to reclaim something valuable that's lost.
Mm-hmm. You know, for me, the thing about the human condition in this movie is the emphasis on small moments. you know, you get Data learning to play for the mm-hmm. first time. You know, Artem teaches him the art of playfulness, and that's an important part of being human. We get Picard and Aneej, with time slowing down, you know, with the hummingbird, you know, in, you know, with its wings beating really, really slowly, and you know, time is slowed down. You can focus on a particular moment.
Moving scenes.
Moving scene, you get Geordi seeing a sunrise for the first time, and that's very moving in and of itself,
yes.
right? Just knowing Geordi's character, and then that this is something that's a total new experience for Geordi, and that's amazing in and of itself. But that's, again, just a moment. And the contrast, in my mind, between these deep moral issues, you know, these ethical conundrums and you know, these high-stakes issues like, you know, like the rights of a small group and forced relocation and colonialism, these are the things that philosophers and political philosophers and sociologists just tend to think about to the point where they can get weighted down. And I think this, what I love about this movie is that, you know, in the midst of all of this chaos about these big issues, there are these small character moments, and human life is just like that. You know, when you're going through a crisis, when you are worried about something, you can almost always find some little thing that brings you joy. And those things aren't necessarily important. It could be a cup of coffee with a friend. It could be seeing a sunrise. It could be, watching an episode of Star Trek, right? You know, in mm-hmm. a way, these aren't really important things in life. You know, that you can list 500 things that are more important than any one of those kinds of moments. But our ability as humans to appreciate the quality and the experience of those small moments is something that does kind of uniquely human thing, as far as we can tell on our planet, right? You know, I don't think my cat has an aesthetic appreciation of these subtle small moments, whereas I feel like I have a different, more subtle appreciation of those kinds of things than other life forms on this planet. Again, this may be harkening back to our previous discussion a few episodes ago on you know, whether animals like whales are conscious and whatnot, but. I think it's easy to forget that, you know, part of the human condition is this appreciation of these small moments that bring joy and add some meaning to life, and they add some color to life. And they're not the big important issues, right? You can list 1,000 big important issues, but we still wake up every day and can find small moments of joy. And if you stop focusing on those and you stop finding those small moments of joy, you can really become a miserable, jaded, stressed out individual, and lose the fact that we can experience joy just as much as we can experience frustration and pain.
Absolutely. I think, too, and something that we haven't talked a lot about that I think gets overlooked in this movie, you know, we talked a little bit about the commentary on a fast-paced society versus a slower pace. We kind of touched on that. But at the heart of this movie is really the story of a prodigal son who has returned not broken and contrite, but rather blinded by his own hatred of his origins, of his people, and his desire to possess what he feels was taken from him, that mm-hmm. perpetual fountain of youth. Ruotho, played masterfully by F. Murray Abraham, who is an actor that I have the utmost respect for. In fact, I think...
Oh, you mean Salieri?
Salieri.
If you've watched Amadeus, yeah.
Yes, okay. Yes, Amadeus, and as you and I talked prior to recording the podcast, another movie that he did, much lesser known, I think it was brilliant, and was a movie called Joshua, which he plays a Catholic priest, and he's just a brilliant actor, and I think it's a shame that we didn't get to see more of Ruotho and Picard on screen together, because these two actors have such great chemistry. They're both very fastidious, and I think it's a shame we didn't get to see more of them together on the screen. But F. Murray Abraham's character, Ruotho, in this movie is so blinded by hatred, and he really doesn't get the credit I think he deserves as a villain, but again, masterfully done. And the fact that his villain is so believable. I mean, Zachary, this isn't a man with super ability. He doesn't have a super intellect. He's super nothing. He is just a man who has, pardon the pun, who has been just stretched to the limits, and he's come home to enact his own vengeance upon his people. And I think that that's almost too real to appreciate.
He's a rebel with a cause.
He is a rebel with a cause. The prodigal, yeah, no, the prodigal has come home.
No, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I actually have, in general, a love-hate relationship with villains in Star Trek. I actually really get tired of the fact that every time there's a Star Trek movie, it's centered around a villain, when so much interesting Star Trek is as a result of exploration and morality plays and adventure and things that don't necessarily require a villain to have interest. And yet without fail, movie after movie after movie, we get another villain, another villain, another villain. And I insofar as we have to have villains in these movies, I'm pleased, like I said in this one, that Ruafo is not a super anything. He's just a guy who's been burned. And yes. He's going to enact some revenge, and he's going to, you know, take things in his own hands, and that's who he is. And you know, he doesn't have superpowers, he doesn't have super intellect. He's just a guy who's hell bent on righting what he thinks is a wrong.
I agree completely, and the fact that he really at his core doesn't look so much unlike you or I, it's just,
well, he's been through a face stretching or two.
He's been through a face stretching or two or three or four. And I think it's safe to say that he does indeed have a face that's as smooth as an android's bottom.
Well, and until he leaks, you know, he does leak all over Picard's ready room.
Well, it's his temper. I mean, every time he loses his temper, he's, you know, when I start to lose my temper, I have this little vein that pops out. Ruafo just starts bleeding all over the place. He's stretched it to the point that it's, you know, it's torn, and they make that point. You know, he's at the point of no return. There is nothing else they can do to rejuvenate him.
Okay, so this is a good question. So, you know, if I'm reading you correctly, you read the Sona as really being at the end of their road. Like, they've lost their ability to keep rejuvenating. This face stretching isn't working. They can't take enough toxins out. So they are on the fast track to death.
Yes.
And so the philosophical connection that I make when I hear that is the connection to Thomas Hobbes and his view of the state of nature, that when you mm-hmm. are faced with you versus someone else, your life versus their life, you know, someone's going to take your food versus you taking their food, you know, absent any kind of society to adjudicate and make social contracts and keep the peace, then it's the state of nature and it's everyone against everyone. There's no such thing as a right or wrong in that situation, because it's everyone against everyone at that point, a war of everyone against everyone, as he put it. So are the Sona totally justified in taking whatever matters into their own hands that they can in order to preserve their own existence, even if it means doing all these terrible things they try to do in the movie? If they're outside the social contract on that view of ethics, then there is no right or wrong. Then they are 100% totally justified, because their own lives are at stake, and that's the end of the story.
Well, that's a very interesting philosophical question. And again, you read what I'm saying correctly. They are at the end of it. It's us or them. And that is absolutely Ruafo's position in this movie. And it doesn't hurt that he harbors some bitterness towards his people. You know, they don't really get into that a whole lot, but it's very, very clear that he is a prodigal character. He left the Baku very bitter when he left, and he is not at all enjoying coming back and seeing them as they are, in the fact that they haven't changed at all. And here he is, you know, he's stretched, he's pulled, he's tucked, and now it's all fallen apart. And so, you know, it's us or them. And that is the predominant thing with him. Where Doherty gets into this, he's trying to do something. He's trying to take something from the Sona and give it to the Federation. So certainly, philosophically speaking, you could argue and justify them both. But I think at the end of the day, I think Kant wins the day. You know, you just cannot... you cannot use force for your own gain and be right.
Yeah, and I think the answer to that, you know, you could read the Sona as saying that they just don't have a choice, right? They're at their wits' end, and they're going to die unless they do this, and all these actions they do in this movie. But they always have a choice, right? They could wait, you know, some of them may not survive, absolutely, but they can try to find door number three. They can keep looking for another place to live. They can keep trying to improve their medicine, whatever it is, right? There's lots of options, and, you know, they've almost become too fatalistic, like, you know, we need to do all this terrible stuff, or else we're all going to die. It strikes me as a bit of a false dilemma.
Yeah, there are other options. You mentioned earlier the scene at the end of the movie with the mother and the son. I believe that character's name is Gallatine. You know, reunited, reconciled with his mother, they can go home. They can go home to their people and be welcome. And I know that they said there's bitterness on both sides, but. Again, you've got Captain Picard there to kind of mediate and negotiate and work with them. There were other options that they just ignored.
And I think that's it exactly. At the end of the movie, you know, Ruafo has made a final choice, essentially not to reconcile and to follow it to his own death, right? He's just on a path, and it's a self-destructive path, and there's nothing you can mm-hmm. do. Whereas Gallatine, I think Picard recognizes in Gallatine that he can still be swayed. He's not totally convinced that he's doing the right thing. He still has this sentimental connection to his home world and his parents and whatnot that's deeply, deeply buried. There's been, you know, decades of resentment built up about that. But he at the end of the movie, he makes a choice to go home, essentially. And that is door number three, right? The Sona can just say, this is stupid. Why don't we just move back to the planet?
Yes. Well, I love that. I love that scene in the movie where Gallatine is leading Picard down the corridor and Picard is kind of in his face. I mean, Picard is not saying nice things to this guy. And he, in fact, he says something to the effect of, you know, you sicken me or something to that effect. And
is it, I pity you or something like that? Or, you know, I forget what it.
Yeah, I forget exactly what he said. But Gallatine turns around and he says, is this how a Federation captain pleads for his life? And he says, no, I'm pleading for yours. And I think that's a very powerful scene because Picard does recognize something in him that is redeemable. And he's going to throw all his chips on the table. This is his last ditch effort to restore, if I can use the phrase, to restore this man's humanity to him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and... You know, and it's totally in line with Picard's character. I mean, Picard always does that, right?
Yes.
If there's a chance of, and he tries to save Shinzon in the very next movie, mm-hmm. right? By trying to convince him, it doesn't work in that case. Just like it doesn't work with Ruafo, but some people it will. And I love that there's this attempt to kind of reason your way out of the situation. Like, look how ridiculous this is, and look what kind of person you've become. Is this really who you want to be? And Picard is really good at asking that question. Who are you? Who do you really want to be? You have a choice. He says that to Shinzon in Nemesis. You know, you have a choice. Make the right one now. And he's essentially doing the same thing with Gallatine here. He's saying, you know, you kind of disappoint and disgust me. You know, look, is this who you want to be? And he puts the mirror back at you. And I think this is kind of like, in a way, it's very philosophical in a very classical sense, right? You, in asking the question, who are you? What do you want to be? By asking these kind of Socratic questions, people can kind of reason their way out of their own situation sometimes. Oftentimes, people deep down know what's right and they know what's wrong, or they know what decision they need to make when faced with a dilemma. And they just need someone to sit them down and say, what do you think you should do? Who do you want to be? What matters to you? And then, you know, people will, you know, whatever's inside of them that points them in the right direction, whether it's reason or whether it's a deep emotional commitment or a moral conviction, that will rise to the surface. But you just need someone to draw that out of you. And Picard is very good at playing that role.
I agree. I agree completely. Well, Zachary, we have rolled past an hour. Do you have any final thoughts?
No, nothing that I haven't already covered, other than maybe, again, just to say that Insurrection is a really underappreciated movie. If you're listening to this and you're telling yourself, I don't like Star Trek Insurrection, give it another chance. You know, if you don't like the humor, just set that aside. If you don't like the what I think is the terrible makeup, just set that aside, you know, and watch it from this moral perspective. You know, there's a really fascinating moral play at work here. You know, you've got two competing groups of people. They each have different needs. you have the rights of each group involved. You've got one group of people that the large group that thinks it's on its deathbed, you know, the Sona. You've got all the benefits from this possibility that can emerge from relocating the Baku and getting the benefits of the metaphasic particles. And then you've got the rights of the 600 Baku, and you have to weigh all this together. It's a really tricky conundrum. There's no obvious answer to that. And it takes Captain Picard being willing to throw away his career to sort through it all and to come through with a moral conviction. And it's a great example of a moral dilemma. It's a great example of personal conviction. It's related to so many different things like civil disobedience. It's related to, you know, a sort of existentialist philosophy with this question about what really matters to you and what are you willing to do about it. It's a deep, deep movie, although I think people just don't view it that way because it's overshadowed by the lightheartedness and the silly comedy in it. So if you're telling yourself you don't like Star Trek Insurrection, please, please, please watch it again and just try to check all the things you don't like and watch it from that philosophical perspective, and you'll see some of the deep-seated Star Trek history that's inside this movie. This attempt to comment on a really deep social problem, you know, people being willing to do terrible things to other people in the name of something good. Think of the countless times that has happened in our own history, and here we are doing it yet again. And mm-hmm. Picard is right there with the sort of moral commentary to say, look, this is just wrong, and here we are. We know this already, and we're doing it again. How can the Federation abandon the Prime Directive? Haven't we covered this already? And yet we're doing it. And that is such human nature, to keep committing the same issues and the same problems again and again and again. And I think this offers a fresh take on it, because you don't see Picard being willing to throw away his career very often. And I love that the stakes are really high in this episode for that reason, or this movie for that reason. So, again, it's never going to be my favorite Star Trek movie. Again, it's actually really hard for me to rank the Next Generation movies. I tend to like First Contact, but, this is definitely not last on my list either. So it's if you're telling yourself you don't like this movie, please watch it again and try to think about some of the things we've been talking about in this episode of Metatrex as you watch it. And maybe, Mike, we should do a commentary episode one of these days where we just comment, our own Metatrex philosophical commentary on a movie. I would love to do an episode of Metatrex like that, about a movie like Insurrection. There's so much there, and I feel like we just barely scratched the surface. You know, there's more to this movie, the subtle nuances that we could talk about, and we could take another hour, but we're not going to waste your time today doing that. But I feel like we could, because there really is a lot of rich content in this movie despite its lightheartedness.
Yeah, exactly. Layer after layer after layer of really rich philosophical content in this movie, and I echo exactly what you just said. I really hope that our listeners will take the time, Zachary, to go back and watch this movie again. And frankly, I think it's more relevant today than it was in December of 1998 when it first released. It's dealing with we talked about colonialism, which seems to be a hot button topic right now, and to some degree with the soon release of Star Trek Beyond. I always want to channel Chris Jones when I say that Beyond. Chris,
that was pretty good. That was pretty good.
Chris, you've started something. It's passable. Chris has started something. But I think about that dialogue that's been started with just the trailer from that movie. I mean, it really seems like that particular movie is going to address colonialism very heavily, and so this movie is really relevant to that debate. We deal with that. We deal, as you said, with civil disobedience, being willing to accept the consequences. We have a pushback here, and this is what I love. We have a pushback of a very popular Star Trek theme: the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. And we have a pushback against that here in this particular movie by asking questions like, how many does it take before it becomes wrong? You know, that what a great question, Captain Picard, to ask, because sometimes the needs of the many do not outweigh the needs of the few. And this, listeners, is a movie that really presents an example of what that might look like. We have this great commentary on, you know, the fast-paced society, a slower pace of life. You know, we're talking about and asking questions about, you know, when you create a machine to do the work of a man, are you taking something away from that man? We live in a society where so many people today feel entitled. I mean, we have our electronic gadgets, and we have all of the conveniences and so few people know what, you know, Zachary, when I was a kid, I was 8, 9 years old when I was going out and mowing yards. And we've talked about this before. I was 12, 13 years old. I got a job making $3.35 an hour mowing along guardrails, not with gas lawn mowers or, you know, electric weed eaters. I was using a sickle and a scythe, you know, sweating, working hard. You know, I understand.
You literally used a sickle?
I literally used a sickle.
I'm just checking.
Yes, literally used a sickle.
It's not a metaphor.
Not a metaphor.
Okay.
Yes, we're talking about doing it the old way, the hard way.
Got it.
We're talking early 1980s in West Virginia. You know, there was a crew of...
Oh, I thought you were going to say the early 1550s.
The early 1550s. It felt like the early 1550s.
If you're over 300 years old.
Yeah. No, we, for whatever reason, we did this the hard way. And, you know, I can remember, you know, earning money and going and buying school clothes. And, you know, we didn't, you know, I bought my first stereo, and I went out and saved the money and bought my first car. And, you know, these things weren't given to me or provided to me. I went out and I earned them, and they weren't even the best. I mean, my first car was a 75 Ford LTD, for Pete's sake. I mean, there was more rust on that thing than there was paint. But the point that I'm making here is we live in this kind of an entitlement society. And I think that's a great theme in this movie. You know, at what point are we creating too much convenience? Are we taking something away from the man? I think is that deep question I wrap my brain around when I see that particular scene in this movie. It's so rich, and I hope our listeners will go back and watch it, because again, I think it's more relevant today than it was in 1998. Yeah, we see Data learn to play, and we see Geordi watching a sunset, and I think LeVar Burton plays that so well, and it's such an emotional scene. And then we find out that, you know, Riker rejuvenated, but his face still isn't as smooth as an android's bottom. So, you know, I laugh, but I enjoy the lightheartedness of this movie. I enjoy the deep philosophical issues. This is a knock it out of the park movie for me. And again, I hope our listeners will go back and watch it with fresh eyes and really dive into the deep topics and have a greater appreciation for Insurrection and all of the things that this movie's saying. It's very complex.
See, as you were talking, Mike, I was trying to envision, do some of these older Baku on this planet, you know, the ones who are 300 years plus, you know, do they have this kind of back in my day story? You know, back in the 21st century, we had to use a sickle to clear our grass. And these young Sona, all they want to do is use the newfangled technologies.
I used to have to walk to school uphill in the snow. Yeah.
I'd like to hear what a Baku back in my day story would be like. But no, I think you're right. You said something that really did resonate to me, that this movie might be more relevant now than it was in the 90s. I think as I look back at the history of the last few decades, I can't think of a spectacular example from the 1990s that this movie is supposed to be an analogy for. Yes, we've got the Native American aspect that we talk about, but that's a long time ago. And then we have the relocation of Japanese Americans in the 1940s. Okay, that's not in the 1990s, right? So what do we have now that's relevant? I'm thinking of things like the influx of Middle Eastern refugees. You know, we have to live somewhere, and we have to decide what to do with them. And you know, there are people that don't want them nearby for, you know, this, that, or the other reason. That might be a good reason or a bad reason. And it's again, the contrast between the needs of a large group and the needs of a small group are in the news now. And in the 90s, I can't remember a great example that this was supposed to be a metaphor for. So, you know, anytime you see a situation like that where you've got a small group of people that have needs that need to be taken into account, and you have a large group of people that doesn't want to deal with it, or they want to ignore it, or they want to do whatever with it, this movie is a great example of how those conflicting needs can play against each other, and the moral conviction that can be necessary to come in and sort through it all. You know, and so I think the connection to civil rights, which is straight up Star Trek, you know, territory, right, is really relevant here. And I think maybe those issues don't get you know, talked about very much when people talk about insurrections. I hope that maybe we've given people a bit more fodder for discussion when insurrection is the topic du jour.
Yeah, if nothing else, you know, when our listeners have a bad day, they can say they had a Ruafo kind of day when they just yell out and their head starts bleeding, and they've had a Ruafo kind of day.
So next time I'm bleeding out my ears or wherever, I'll just tell myself it's a Ruafo day.
It's just a Ruafo kind of day.
There are days. As Picard says in this movie, there are days.
There are days.
Well, it's been fun talking about Star Trek Insurrection, but this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
And I'm saying this in a really good and loving way. Sometimes some things can't be unseen, but there is nothing cooler than Disco Bones. I mean, I know we're supposed to be in the 23rd century somewhere, but that was squarely 1970-something.
Oh, yeah, sure. It was perfect.
The Orb.
I love the Jumja stick. He's like, yeah. You know, here's this and this and this, and here's the Jumja stick. And I was picturing, like, in a Bajoran hotel, like, when housekeeping comes in and they make the bed in the hotel, do they put, like, a Jumja stick on the pillow? Because that seems like it would be really messy.
The 602 Club.
You can definitely see that something does probably need to change, you know, for the Avengers. But is that what needs to change, that they need to have the oversight from somebody else? And the fear of Cap is really that we kind of started off on this road to serfdom.
Saturday Morning Trek.
The 30 seconds that we spent on Scotty singing probably could have been used with a really fun, why are all these women in security uniforms standing around us?
Rather than just, you're more handsome than ever.
Yeah, that, what was that about?
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network through Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm. You'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and many more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or to send us your thoughts on anything we discussed in this episode of MetaTreks, you can contact us in several different ways. You can contact us via a form on Trek FM's website. Just go to trek.fm/contact.
You can also leave us a voicemail. Look in the sidebar on the show page or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
On Twitter, you can find us under the handle @trekfm.
On Facebook, you can find us at facebook.com/trekfm. Also, while you're there, check out the Babel Conference. Type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar.
We also invite you to leave a rating and a review of MetaTreks on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show, and it's one of the most important things you can do to help other listeners find the show. Well, Mike, when you're not telling 300-year-old back-in-my-day stories, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, Zachary, they can find me on Facebook. That's where I'm most active, and certainly around the Babel Conference. On Twitter, my Twitter handle is @cmichael1701. I'm also on Instagram, cmichael1701. And Zachary, when you are not desperately trying to hide your gorge, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, on Facebook, you can find me in the Babel Conference, Trek FM's listener group, if you want to talk Star Trek and philosophy with me there. I'm also an associate producer of The Ready Room, Trek FM's flagship show, and I'm a frequent guest on that show as well. In fact, there's a running joke that I sleep on a cot in the corner of The Ready Room. I'm on there quite often recently. And on Twitter, you can find me under the handle at Zachary Fruhling. It's just my name, Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. We'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the Metatrex team from the network, specifically C. Brian Jones, the founder and publisher of Trek.fm, our executive producers, Charlene Schmidt, Matthew Rushing, and Norman Lau, Aaron Harvey, our art director, Will Wynn, our content manager, Richard Marquez, our production manager, and Dennis Costello, our editor and producer. And we'd like to give a special shout out and a thank you to Patrick Devlin, our associate producer. You can find Patrick under the handle at MagicDrop5 on Twitter, and we really want to thank Patrick for his support of Metatrex and Trek.fm. Well, everyone, thanks for listening to Metatrex, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.